get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
They're saying I should think stuff. Something is wrong with me.
To be so cynical.
Practice. Welcome to Positive Cynicism. It's the first episode of 2019, which, again, I don't really care about time and podcasting because you could be listening to this in 2022, in which case, well, at least we made it to 2022. I think after 2018 was crazy enough. I got a feeling 2019 is going to be even crazier. And we're starting off, we started off 2019 on kind of a sad note. I am joined real quick by Travis Yates, who is always here for the first week of the month on Positive Cynicism. Travis, welcome to the show.
Yes, happy new year. And you can listen to this whenever you want. It just needs to be at the first of a year. So it could be January 2025.
There you go.
Just make sure you listen to this top of the year. So happy new year, everybody.
There you go. Travis, I hinted, though, that we started on a sad note. For you and I, and probably for a few of the listeners who are wrestling fans, we're going to steal some of Kevin Hunsberger from My 1-2-3 Cents topics. But the wrestling world lost a legend at the beginning of 2018, and a guy that you had met when we went to WrestleMania 27 in Atlanta, and that is Mean Gene Okerlund.
A true legend indeed, and I think that... You know, to see the outpouring of love and respect and the mainstream media coverage that he got. I mean, the New York Times ran an article on his death and a profile of his career, and that's just a testament to how far-reaching his impact and his voice really reached in his career. So definitely a sad time and kind of out of nowhere. I mean, certainly he wasn't a spring chicken, but you know, he'd been very active and working some of the cons and going on podcasts, and so it did kind of come out of nowhere. I'm very, very surprised.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, he was such a beloved figure in not only the wrestling world, but he transcended wrestling. I think a lot of people know who Mean Gene was just by name, maybe not by appearance. And he was recently in a commercial with Kevin Hart. But I think even as podcaster, a lot of aspiring wrestling announcers, you know, use him as an example of what they aspire to be. But I think even in the podcasting world, Mean Gene was an influence to anyone who listened to him. And I know certainly here on this show, trying to, you know, have the comedic timing, the straight man personality that he had is something that even I aspire to.
Absolutely. You know, I growing up being such a fan of wrestling, but ultimately going into broadcasting, it was the broadcasters in wrestling that I always looked up to and emulated. And you know, he and Bobby Heenan were such an amazing on-camera duo. And sure, you know, very inspiring. And like you said, we still try to get it right, where he just seemed to do it so naturally. And, you know, you listen to everyone that worked with him, and that's what they said, too, was we would just follow Mean Gene's lead. And that's really saying something when you have all these greats in a profession saying that about you.
That's true. And hopefully on this episode we can use Mean Gene's professionalism and ability to roll with the punches, because we're going to try something a little different for this first episode of 2019. Hopefully this goes well. I don't know how it's going to go, but we'll see. We are doing the random wheel of pop culture, where we have random topics that neither Travis or I know what is in the pot, so to speak. And we are going to just pull random topics at random and see if we can freestyle a conversation about them. Are you excited or scared?
Oh, boy. Little of both. Spin the wheel, make the deal, as Mean Gene would roll his eyes at, right?
There you go, yeah.
Let's do it. There's no shortage of things to talk about as we enter 2019. So, yeah, let's get to it.
All right, here we go with the first wheel. Topic number one is Celine Dion.
Ooh. Wow.
Celine Dion was, I don't know how big of a hit it was earlier this year, but she had the song, I believe it was called Ashes from Deadpool 2. And, of course, most famously known for the Titanic theme song, My Heart Will Go On. So that's what I have on Celine Dion. What do you got, Travis?
Is it safe to now call Celine Dion the female Kenny Loggins?
Ooh.
Because that's all I can remember her for as well, is soundtracks.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know she has a Vegas show and she's had multiple albums, but yeah, I couldn't tell you any other song that Celine Dion has recorded.
I'm right there with you. Didn't she host for a while? Was she a host of one of the, you know, contestant shows of You Can Sing, You Can Dance, You Can Do Something on stage? I feel like maybe.
Maybe. I don't have any knowledge of that, but it would not surprise me.
Maybe. You think you're Canadian? Maybe that.
Are you smarter than a Canadian?
So you think you're Canadian? Yeah. Hey, are you smarter than a Canadian, eh? Hosted by Celine Dion. It seems to me like Celine Dion would be poised for a comeback in 2019, as neither one of us really has much on her for 2018.
But this is
minus a
this is an interesting point.
Soundtrack.
Yeah, she obviously is very popular because she's been doing the Vegas thing for years, mm-hmm. and people go and see her. But yeah, it's one of those. I guess she falls into that category of famous for being famous, or because mm-hmm. I mean, granted, the Titanic song was hugely popular, and you know, helps when it's the number one movie in the world. But yes, why has Celine Dion endured a lasting legacy on the basis of one song? I mean, Dexy's Midnight Runners aren't playing Vegas.
You know, this reminds me of something that Darius Rucker came out and said several years ago when Hootie and the Blowfish essentially broke up, and then Darius Rucker did a, you know, complete shift and entered the country music realm. He said that they were breaking up not because, you know, of anything, you know, any band turmoil or anything like that. He said that just that modern audiences did not want to hear their music, that they didn't want to hear some 40-something pop singers, that it was, you know, it was the Justin Biebers of the world that people were now tuned into, and the Taylor Swifts. And that really kind of stuck in my head every time I look at the modern music landscape, because you look around and you say, where are the Billy Joels? Where are the Elton Johns? Even the Madonnas at this point, where are they? And Celine Dion, I think, might fall into that category. You know, do we have some ageism happening to some degree in the music industry where audiences just immediately start tuning out artists if they're, you know, past a certain age, regardless of their talent?
That's a valid point. And I would also go with trends will always change. You figure about every 5-6 years, something new is going to come along. But why is it that once something new comes in, that the old stuff is immediately just pushed aside and never, you know, it's considered out of style, but also unpopular to listen to? Your comment about Darius Rucker reminds me of a conversation that I once had when I was in college producing a 80s style metal show. And I'd done an interview with the band Warrant, and this was like 1994, 95. And I called up Columbia Records, their label, and tried to get some videos. And the guy that I was talking to, who worked in the record industry, whose job it was to promote bands, was like, you know, I don't think anybody wants to listen to Warrant anymore. Everybody, you know, we can give you Soul Asylum, Mike Watt, Stone Temple Pilots, or Alice in Chains, whichever one was on Columbia. But it's like, okay, I just told you that I just interviewed this band and I played it. And granted, they were playing clubs at this point, not arenas, but people still want to listen to that. Why is it that we just immediately discard what was fashionable, mm-hmm. you know, a year or two ago?
And does it go hand in hand with how we've just become such a disposable society as far as you know, nothing is saved anymore. You know, our media is streamed and then gone. And, you know, we're not in the era of owning DVDs or even VHSs anymore, where it's a permanent fixture. You know, so I think a lot of that has to go with our attention spans and just the way we consume media these days. And so acts themselves, artists, are becoming disposable oftentimes too. And yeah, you're not seeing the mainstays anymore, because we're just the next great thing was always there, but I think we're just seeing it ramped up now in today's society.
Yeah, and I've had this discussion many times and may have had it with you before in the show. It's, you know, in like right now in 2019, you know, Bruce Springsteen's still out there. New Kids on the Block are going back out on tour this summer. You have all these bands that are older that still pack a crowd, but who is going to be doing this in 30 years? That's popular now, because it seems like a lot of artists now, due to the digital accessibility, who kind of put out albums or singles faster than, you know, like right now, I think a single or an album is available for digital. So all the singles are counted as individual right off the start, instead of the traditional release the album, release a single, 4 months later, you release the next single, and you keep promoting the album. Whereas now, an album is promoted for, you know, very limited time, and then you have to put out new product much faster, I feel.
Yeah, and this will probably become a tying back to our previous discussion on nostalgia. I could see the album format coming back eventually in a nostalgia kind of way, as far as, you know, that'll be kind of the way it's promoted. Hey, it's the album, it's not the single, go get the whole album, sort of thing. And then people that used to buy you and I and others a little younger than us will remember that and say, oh yeah, you know, I'm going to get Taylor Swift's whole album instead of just the single, because that's the way we used to do it. I don't know if Taylor Swift's a good example, but I could see that becoming a thing of nostalgia, you know, 5-10 years from now.
Yeah, and I think with the popularity of vinyl coming back into play, that could be a good observation.
Absolutely.
So, all right, well, that was Celine Dion, somewhat. Let's spin the wheel and move on to topic number two. Next topic on the list is Count Chocula.
Wow. Breakfast cereals that comfort breakfast cereal, perhaps? I don't know. Certainly, I don't think there's a lot of nutritional value in Count Chocula. You don't see any commercials for Count Chocula. You know, this is a part of a series of, I'm not sure if it was General Mills or who actually makes Count Chocula, but you had, right, you had other cereals based on these character. Boo Berries was a big one, right? Mm-hmm. Count Chocula, not sure what others there were, but I'm sure there was one or two. You know, overrated, maybe, perhaps, with the overdose of chocolate in Count Chocula. I mean, the name is right. We've got, you know, chocolate cereal bits with chocolate marshmallows. But again, much like Celine Dion, have you heard of Count Chocula lately? Have you bought Count Chocula lately? Can you buy Count Chocula at a regular grocery store?
So
I don't know the answer.
Oh, so you don't know that every Halloween season, and I don't know if Count Chocula is available year-round, or if it's just around September, October, they put out Count Chocula, Frankenberry, Boo Berry, and I believe the last couple of years they've brought back Fruit Brute, I believe is his name.
Oh.
So yes, there's a whole line of cereal, Halloween-themed cereals that are very popular, at least one month out of the year. And yeah, I mean, these are, you know, going back to nostalgia again, these were cereals from our youth that I think that's why the nostalgia plus the limited availability is what makes people run out and buy them whenever they do come out, because you can only, if you can only buy it, you know, a month or two out of the year, you go out and you buy 6-7 boxes, or maybe that's just me. I don't know.
Yeah. It's like Thin Mints, right? You grab them and you put them in your freezer, just a freezer full of Count Chocula.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, what's interesting for our generation, so, you know, the 35 to 45 kind of range, or 30 to 50, wherever you want to put us in, it's interesting. It's an interesting place to be, because we are the adults of the world and the parents of the world that are now giving our children the experience that we had, and that seems so close to, you know, yet they're, you know, we're 30, 40 years removed now from our early childhoods. But yet it seems still just so close and just like yesterday. And so the industries know this, and they're playing to that with things like this. You know what? We know that parents will see Count Chocula and want to buy it, or the series, the Booberry and Frankenberry, and I'd never heard of the other or even seen the other one. That's interesting. But anyway, even for around Halloween, which is a brilliant marketing plan, you know, it can't be cheap to then, you know, for only a few months a year, roll out all the packaging, roll out this, you know, the specific branding that they're going to use for that. So it's obviously working and it's profitable. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep doing it. But it shows that they're, you know, they're playing to us. We are kind of the, even though last episode we talked about how the youth is kind of taking over to some degree and setting some trends, we still have the buying power. Mm-hmm. We still have the purchasing power. And, or I guess I shouldn't say still, I'd say we have it now, because we're the adults in the room. It's scary sometimes. And so, you know, Count Chocula is kind of an example of that, where they're going to play to our, to the nostalgia factor, and to, the fact that we're the adults in the room and the parents in the room buying the cereals. And so they're going to keep, you know, pumping it out, knowing that, oh, there's this cereal, there's this product from my childhood. I'm now going to buy it for my child, and maybe even on the weekends have a sneak a bowl myself.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, because we are 30, 35 years past our youth. Let's say, you know, the 80s are 30 years from the 2010s, whatever. Growing up in the 80s, that same time frame would have been the 1950s. In the 50s, as a kid, the 50s seemed like so long ago. It was such a, you know, distant time. Whereas, and kids today probably feel the same way about the 80s. But for us, it's like the 80s are like, that was just last week. Like, you know, where did this time go? So I think also in our generation, our generation is kind of the first Peter Pan generation, where we grew up with these cereals, with video games, cartoons, all the stuff that I don't think it's just nostalgia that keeps it going along. I think it's because let's see if I can say this properly. Video games were, or home video games were a new thing during our youth. Home movies, or, you know, home video, all this stuff, where instead of going out, I guess, and moving on to being an adult, what we would consider being an adult, our generation has kept to what kept them, what they did as a kid. So it's, again, it's this Peter Pan generation of, are we not growing up as we should?
That is spot on, Chad. You know, when you look around, and we have grown up, but there's so many instances where it's clear that we haven't grown up, or didn't grow up the way we should have. Mm-hmm. You know, when we have this term adulting, which I know the kids use a lot, but frankly, I see a lot of people my age use it as well. And don't stop using that. Like, you've been an adult for a long time. So stop. You're not adulting. You're being yourself. You're being who you should be. So yeah, the Peter Pan kind of lifestyle of we did grow up, but it was stunted, I feel. Mm-hmm. I certainly feel like the generation before us, our parents' generation, they became adults a lot sooner than we did. And, you know, they certainly made their share of mistakes as well. I mean, our generation was the first generation of divorce, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, they kind of screwed the pooch there with that, but they still grew up a lot more arguably and sooner than we did. And so yeah, that also begs the question of, if it's generational, what does this next generation look like? If we can admit to at least some degree that, yeah, we, you know, you can call it whatever you want. In some cases, it is staying young at heart. But then in other cases, it's just shirking your responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to be an adult, be a grown up when you need to. And some people struggle with that, even at you know, in their 30s and 40s. And so what's the next generation going to look like with everything? But we've kind of talked quite a bit about that in previous episodes. Yeah. But it's just it's another question to ponder. But that's a great way to frame it, with, you know, looking at the pop culture that we grew up with and how it's affected the way we've transitioned from, you know, adolescent to adulthood.
Yeah.
All because of Count Chocula.
All because of Count Chocula. Yes, I'm going to go have a bowl after we record this episode. I've got 6 more boxes stashed in the cabinets. Yes.
Ration them wisely.
Yeah, I've got to spread them out through 10 more months. So
9 months, yeah.
All right, let's spin that wheel and find out what comes up next. All right, are you ready for this? The next topic is Back to the Future. Travis, I got a feeling you're going to have a lot to say about this one, because I believe this is one of your favorite movies.
So much to say, and not only one of mine, but naturally, organically became my son's. Some days believes he's Marty McFly, and living in Florida, where it's you know, the average is 80 something, my son will throw on jeans and sneakers and his red vest and long sleeve shirt, because he wants to be Marty McFly for the day, and it'll be 90 degrees, and I'm like, what, parent of the year here with my son who's sweating away. We were at Old Navy, and he was dressed like this, and we stumbled across the vests that are back. Those, what is it, puffy down vest that with, you know, the sleeveless, that was popular when Back to the Future was made, and of course, you know, made more famous by Michael J. Fox wearing it as Marty McFly in the movie. And I was, yeah, you know, I turned to Lucas and I said, my son, and I said, you know, you're a trendsetter. Look, you've been wearing this for, you know, a year at least. And now it's just coming back into style in pop culture. So, you know, kudos to him for trying to be a trendsetter. What a wonderful movie that, you know, celebrated pop culture, celebrated the past. You know, you just mentioned the two decades that were in the movie. So you really, when you, you know, something that movie kind of does is set the table for the iconic decades. You know, every decade is known for something. And, but certainly, you know, we had the movie was set in the 80s, and then he went back to the 50s. And, you know, those are the two decades that you just brought up. And, you know, also it's kind of generational with the baby boomers growing up in the 50s, and then us, this generation, growing up in the 80s. And then now you have generation and the millennials and the, you know, they'll talk about the 2000s for them. But, you know, certainly the 80s and the 50s were two iconic generations that kind of, we benchmark generations, if you will, or benchmark decades, and, you know, very much celebrated and a great juxtaposition set in that film with those two, you know, the two places of time that he's going back to. You know, the neat thing too about that film is, you know, there's so much to talk about. Eric Stoltz was the original Marty McFly. They shot almost the entire first movie with him, and then they decided it just wasn't working. And so they recast Michael J. Fox, who was working on Family Ties at the time and continued to work on Family Ties. And so he was putting in like 20-hour days. He would shoot Family Ties and then during the day, and then he would show up and they would do a lot of filming at night for the first Back to the Future. And then he would sleep for a couple hours and then he'd be right back on set for Family Ties. And so, you know, for such a, and he, in both of those roles, he showed such energy and such, you know, youthfulness and just uniqueness of character. And so the fact that he was doing that on just barely any sleep is really a testament to young Michael J. Fox and his acting chops.
Yeah. I don't know how, you know, he was able to do so. And keep, not only that, but like you said, it's two different characters. So keeping them separate and consistent. But going back to the nostalgia factor of the 50s, I wonder, I've always thought this with movies set in the 50s. Is that, and even going further way back, and we can tie this into Back to the Future 3, with the Wild Wild West era, is there a accuracy in these films, excuse me, or is it the nostalgia factor of what we wanted those times to be like? Or as we've said on this show, if we wrote a movie based on the 80s, would it be an accurate representation of the 80s or the rose-colored glasses version of the 80s?
Right. And then you have to factor in where were you in that time, because you and I previously discussed, for example, looking at the Goldbergs right now, the ABC sitcom, and it is set in the 80s. And so we kind of can do that. We can say, how are they portraying the 80s? And it's portrayed in a very fun, fun-loving light. And that's fine, because that's accurate for you and I, because we were young then. Mm-hmm. And so the glasses, not only are they rose-colored, but they're young-colored. That's not a thing, but they're seen through the young eyes. So again, just to touch upon things we discussed in a previous episode, you know, you're looking at things without the pressures of paying bills and the pressures of your career and raising a family. You know, you just have being young and being a kid to worry about. And so that makes things a lot lighter and more colorful and vibrant, you know, your life in general. And so as we look back, as Adam Goldberg portrays his life in growing up in the 80s, it's seen as that. It's seen as fun and colorful and just funny stories. And then I love, if you've never seen the Goldbergs, every episode ends with a little nugget of truth from the episode where he will have, you know, videos that he recorded with his own home video recorder. And so you're saying to yourself, oh, this could not have been true. And then you get this little morsel of, oh, yes, it was, because here's the footage to back it up. And so, you know, I think it's, you know, who's looking back at the time? Who's looking back at the 50s? You know, if it's one of our grandparents, well, they were the ones raising the kids. So their vision of the 50s is going to be a lot different than our parents who were growing up then and probably did see it as this idyllic, you know, time, the way it's presented in most popular culture. So, I think that there's certainly accuracy in the way it's portrayed, but it also who's looking back on it, who's reflecting back. And I think that's where the true accuracy will lie in terms of art is subjective. And so when we portray a certain time period in film and television, whoever's looking back on that time, they're going to look back to you know, their age and their experiences when they were growing up then or an adult then. And so that's going to play a big role in how accurate to them it is.
True, true. Now, here's the depressing thought, tying back into Back to the Future. Back to the Future 2 took place in the future. We are now, as of this recording, 4 years beyond where Back to the Future 2 took place. So everything in Back to the Future is really Back to the Past now.
Yeah, I don't like to think about things like that, Chad. So I would just appreciate moving on from that point. No, it is funny to... And a lot of films have done that now. You know, you look back at Escape from L.A., mm-hmm. which was set in now, I think, past time, yeah. even though it was set in the future. And, you know, it's funny to see whenever you have a futuristic movie, you're essentially we're getting a glimpse of how we saw ourselves in the future. And so now we can look back at it and see how accurate we were. And so that's pretty cool. You know, a lot of trash fires in the future movie and dystopian films, you know, everybody's just, you know, out burning trash in the street and, trying to stay warm. Mm-hmm. So a lack of housing and heat apparently in the future.
Yeah.
But it is neat to, yes, it is depressing because it means that we're getting older, but it's also neat to see, okay, how accurate was our portrayal of where we thought we'd be in whatever, you know, year the movie was set in. So that's kind of neat to go back. And of course, everybody had fun with the Cubs when, you know, the joke of the Cubs winning the World Series. And then, you know, a couple years later, they actually did. So they even had to go further than what was projected in, you know, 1987 or whenever the film was made.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite films is The Apple, which came out in 1980, but was set in 1994. And let's just say they did not get a whole lot right in their futuristic world. But I think one of the film series that is probably most accurate as far as predicting at least technology is the Star Trek series.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very interesting.
Yeah. There's you have, you know, dissertations written about Star Trek and the Star Trek technology and so many social messages embedded in Star Trek and so certainly, yeah, that's and we're talking going back to when did Star Trek debut the television series in the 60s?
Yeah, I believe, you know, 65 or so.
Yeah, there's an interesting movie. It's an independent film. It's available, I think, on Netflix. It's called Turbo Kid. Have you seen it?
I have heard of it, but I've not actually seen it.
It's so fantastic because it plays with all of these. So instead of trying to pop a future, it goes back and it's rewriting. So it's set in the 90s. But it's an alternate version of the 90s. And so it has a lot of fun, and it totally pays homage to the, you know, goriness of 80s movies. And, you know, it's, you know, supposedly, you know, it's set in a world in the future, but it's, the future is 1997 and it was made in 2015. So, you know, it, right off the bat, it's having fun with itself by kind of creating a revisionist history, on, you know, in film. So that's worth a look just to see how it plays with time and, you know, creating the, you know, what film does that? Every film that's made, you know, is set in the future from the date that it's made. This movie, Turbo Kid, creates a future that's already past. So it's a lot of fun. So it's, you know, something worth checking out if you're interested in the, you know, the way movies create the futures and the past.
That's interesting. I was not familiar with the plot, so I will definitely have to check that out.
But, yeah, you gotta like action gore, or at least just if you're a fan of Tarantino, that sort of thing. I think you'll get a kick out of it.
Okay. Yeah, I think we're at that halfway point now in the show, so I want to give a little shout out to another podcast that I feel this episode was not really inspired, but very similar, kind of, sort of, maybe, in the way that I'm just going to promote them. It's a podcast called ABC D-Bags, and Travis, I don't know if you're familiar with this podcast, but each episode they take a letter and then pick a word that starts with that letter and base their entire episode around that. So I want to give them a shout out because they have been loyal supporters here of the Positive Cynicism and the whole Jittery Monkey Family, My 123 Cents, and Nerds United. So shout out to ABC D-Bags. You can find them on your podcasting catching applications.
I love it. I love it.
All right. Halfway home. Spin the wheel. Make the deal. Next topic. Well, this seems kind of fitting, seeing how we're going to be getting into probably the political spectrum of 2020, and that is Oprah Winfrey.
Okay. Well, I think that just looking at Oprah, and I think that it's a great example of the short attention spans that we currently display with our current events. You know, it seems like she was just, you know, wallpapered all over the media when there was a talk last, geez, was it last fall, maybe last summer, about her potentially running for president. And, you know, it took about a week for her to finally shoot it down or for us to stop talking about it. But then that was it. There's been no more Oprah. So we get a week almost constantly on every 24-hour show, on, you know, the morning talk shows, Oprah this, Oprah that. We're going to talk to somebody who's close to her. And then that's it. Then we move on, and there's just no more discussion. So if anything, I think that she's a good illustration for just how quickly someone can enter the news cycle with a full force and then just exit just as quickly.
True. Now, did you ever watch her show
when she was on? Yeah, I grew up in Chicago, and she filmed in Chicago, obviously, no secret there. And so I did. You know, I was younger, 80s, so watching Oprah wasn't on my on my everyday to-do list, but it was hard to miss her growing up in Chicago as well. So I was certainly probably more aware of her early on than others. I think that as a person, I think that she's a very underrated actor. She's been in some fantastic movies, and very, you know, she chooses some powerful roles. And she's just such a force for good. She does such wonderful things, and you know, she just has this positive energy about her. And you know, we need more Oprahs. You know, Ellen DeGeneres is another one that kind of reminds me of Oprah, and not just because she now has a talk show, but just the you just don't see enough of that. And she, what makes me disappointed is that she's unliked in many circles, and I won't point too many fingers, but I think most of us know what circle I'm talking about, but she's unliked by some circles. And it's like, how do you not like Oprah? I mean, or at least not like what she stands for. So that's disappointing. But yeah, I think that she's just a wonderful human being, and we need more Oprah in our lives.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because her talk show, and I, you know, looking back, I'm sure I've seen episodes, but like you, it was not, you know, I'd come home from school and it was like, do I want to watch Oprah or He-Man, you know? And so my memories of the Oprah show are more of, I guess, the things that went viral before going viral was a thing, like Tom Cruise jumping on the couch, or, you know, you get a car, and just spot issues instead of actual whole episodes. But I think when she came out, and you look at the other talk shows that were around that time, Donahue, Sally Jesse, you know, even Jerry Springer, like, I think she stood out because her show wasn't a circus. It was more about, like you said, being positive and focusing more on the human condition instead of exploiting. And I think that's something that is sadly missing in today's society, where now you look at reality shows and it is more about exploiting a person or a genre than uplifting.
Yeah, that's. I was going to compare her show to some of the others, and you nailed it. The way she presented guests and just topics overall compared to some of the other, you're just more crazy Donahue's of mm-hmm. the world. Yeah, so that's a great. She rose above it, and she's just so multi-talented. You know, to start as a talk show host, mm-hmm. and then to go to being a media mogul is just an actress, and just wonderful. She's very talented, yeah, it's I can't say enough good things about Oprah.
Now I'm just sitting here, and if you're not a wrestling fan, this will probably make no sense to you, but I think you'll get it, Travis. Could you imagine Ric Flair being interviewed by Barbara Walters and Oprah Winfrey? How many tears would that man shed?
Oh, boy. That would be a thing of beauty. I'd love to see that. It'd be a good. It'd be through all the tears. They'd have a lot of fun, and Ric would have a lot of fun with them. That'd be quite the interview. And how would that work? Like a tag team interview? Like does Oprah tag Barbara in, and then, you know, she gets a couple tear jerking questions in, and then tags Oprah back in, and then, you know, good cop, bad cop almost sort of thing, right? Oprah would kind of lift him back up, yep. and then Barbara would go back on the attack again. That'd be great. That'd be awesome. Pay-per-view. I'd pay money to see that.
Awesome. Yeah. And like you said, Oprah, I mean, I know she was just in Wrinkle in Time, which came out in 2018. I don't think it was as big of a hit for Disney as they expected, but you know, when Disney owns everything, they can afford one or two missteps. But yeah, Oprah, has she been in anything besides Color Purple and Beloved? She was in something else, right? You know her?
Yeah, gosh, I'm trying to think of her filmography. She's been in a lot. But I can't tell you off the top of my head, but certainly Color Purple was the first thing that came to mind, and I also just recently saw A Wrinkle in Time, and you know, such a perfect Oprah role. She played this larger than life force for good for humans. But yeah, I can't at the top of my head cite her entire filmography.
Okay. Yeah, I was just trying to think. And then real quick, going into the speculation of her running for president, one of the things that I think keeps people from running, at least people with common sense, is that your entire life is going to be thrown out there into the public light, and even secrets or made up things. So do you think Oprah would want her, her personality to be targeted as for character assassination? Or do you think Oprah is possible to assassinate the character of Oprah? Does she have some bodies hidden somewhere?
Well, I think she's such a large public figure that she's already gone through that. I don't think there's a whole lot more to uncover that people haven't tried to uncover. So I think she would be immune to that to some degree because of her celebrity status already. I mean, certainly you'll see more than, you'd see blatant lies, things like that come out. And so maybe she's just not up to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, she's a bit of an open book. See what I did there?
I got that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. That's a good one. she's gone to war with the beef industry, over the food libel laws. She's been in the trenches. She knows what it's like to be out there for everyone to see. And so I don't think that would dissuade her from running at all.
All right. What about, what position then would Dr. Phil get in her cabinet? Surgeon General? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, he's so much more of a in your face kind of guy, right? Mm-hmm. So Attorney General, maybe. I think that might be a role for him.
All right. Well, stay tuned through 2019 and 2020, see what happens. But now, let's move on to the next topic. All right, this one's interesting, and one that I have struggled with over the last couple weeks, and that is Twitter. For having this podcast, and one of my goals—I don't like saying goals now—but one of my to-do lists for 2019 is to try to get the word out about the podcast, try to gain a following. And I understand that to do that, I have to use social media to reach out to people. But I really don't like social media, and so it's I think I've discussed this on previous episodes where it's this Jekyll and Hyde persona where I think there is good value in social media, but it is trumped, no pun intended, by all the negative parts of social media, which is giving voice to anonymous people who don't use the responsibility wisely.
I agree with that. And it really is, to some degree, it's how you use it. I tried to purge my Twitter account of all negative things. And I use it mostly for information. But even then, you can't control who's posting on the people you do follow. So that negativity, sometimes you can't escape it no matter how hard you try without just deleting your account and leaving completely. I do think that eventually, if we continue down this path, and I don't see why we're not going to continue down the path, that most of social media will just become a wasteland of those types of people that you were just discussing. Just a breeding ground for negativity, breeding ground for disinformation. The self-serving kind of use, it's the uses and gratifications theory come true here with, surrounding yourself with opinions that only support, your beliefs. And so you're not getting any outside opinion. And if you do, it's presented in such a negative light or in a silly argument that it's immediately discounted. And so, yeah, Twitter, I think it's certainly each social media platform has kind of a different feel and a different purpose. You certainly see more family-related things on Facebook. And then on Instagram, you've got more celebrity things. And Twitter's kind of a middle ground of that. I'm still enjoying Twitter for news and information. But like I said, I had to go through and delete specific accounts that either the poster themselves was too negative or the consistent following on that person was too negative. And so I'm already starting to see the beginning almost, if I'm going to prophesize here, the beginning of the end for me as far as using Twitter. Or only using it for NFL draft news and things like that, which ironically is when I first jumped on Twitter, was when I was promoting Draft IQ, the yearly draft guide that I put out. So again, just like you mentioned with, supporting podcasts, following podcasts, things of that nature, it's such a fantastic and powerful platform. However, so many negative voices are really ruining the experience.
Yeah, I know. I've had to unfollow people and things that because of – it's not only the negative, but it's like when it's only like one topic that they just keep tweeting out or promoting. And it's like, okay, I saw it the first 5 times you said the same thing. I don't need another 50 in the course of a day. But the other factor that you kind of mentioned is – And this goes into even our news landscape through traditional media is news versus opinion, where people will throw out an opinion article and cite it as news. And where that line between the two is growing so thin that I think a lot of people don't understand the difference that there is legitimate news articles, and then there's somebody just telling you, well, this happened, and here's my thoughts on it. And it, you know, I use social media and the internet for wrestling news as well. And it's the same thing where people will speculate about something, and then, but it's not actual news. And so I'm trying to figure out how we can curb that downward trend and get people to realize not everything you see, one, is factual, and two, is newsworthy.
Yeah, I think that the social media, the rise of social media, certainly helped give way to the lack of reliance on mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And as you said, then it ties in with the opinion versus news and just a general overall distrust of a lot of media and kind of the group mentality that's now so easy to fall right into, where we don't have to do a lot of the critical thinking for ourselves if we don't want to, because we will just follow the voices, the groups that we're associating with on social media. So in the political realm and in the current events realm, I think social media has become a very damaging tool out there. And I, you know, Twitter really needs to get a hand on how they restrict and penalize, threatening language and hate language. They're very slow and very inconsistent in the way they assess, posts and when they go on the attack, when people, go on the attack on other people. And so that's frustrating as well to see. You'd like to see some very hardline, strict policies in place where people are kicked off, where, tweets are immediately deleted. But you see these horror stories all the time of darn near death threats. And then, people will then share that they complained to Twitter. Twitter responded and said, oh, we don't see a problem with it. And it's like, well, that's a problem right there. So you'd like to see them really. And then, of course, you've got – then you get into the world of all the bots and the fake accounts and things like that. And so, boy, there's a lot of manipulation happening out there. And, we're just as a society not smart enough anymore to be counted on to decipher it all ourselves. So, it's a double-edged sword, because let's go back to the very top of the show when you sent out condolences about Mean Gene. Mm-hmm. And what you get there and what I've gotten is you get to collectively grieve, when a staple of our childhood passed. It was healing to see all the voices and all the great memories and all the love versus doing it on your own. It seems much more depressing to do it that way, I think. And so social media can be a force for good in so many different ways. But then it's a double-edged sword for sure. If you look up double-edged sword in the dictionary right now, I think social media would be the first thing that we'd
picture. Yeah, I don't, and this is something that I have struggled with ever since joining Twitter several years ago, is I don't understand the reasoning behind people sending hate tweets. Like, for me, and I mean, if you follow me on Twitter, which you can do, at ChatSmart, you will see that any negative stuff that I tweet is usually directed towards Kevin Hunsberger, but that's because he and I are good friends and we're joking back and forth with each other. We're just putting what we normally would have done in text message out there for the public. So there's no seriousness between our conversation. But if someone else, let's say, for example, Kevin Hart, this whole Oscar controversy of tweets that he sent out back in 2011 came out, I would not go on Twitter and bash him. I would just say, okay, I don't approve of what he said. I don't agree with him. If I don't want to support him, I'm not going to watch the Oscars or I'm not going to watch his next film. But I don't see a need to go on social media and, as the kids say, put someone on blast, which they probably don't say anymore. But, it's a thing. It's like, why? And there have been times where, yes, I'll have a thought go through my head real quick when I see a tweet, and I'm like, no, I don't need to put a response out there because it isn't positive. And, you know, this whole show is about being positive and cynical at the same time. But it's that thing where you don't, just because you have a thought, keep it in your head. Don't, you don't need to bash other people. And I don't understand why, you know, part of it may be because it's anonymous, because it's easier to say something in text instead of saying something to somebody's face. But I just don't understand why, when you have this medium that could be used for so much good, why it has to be used for you know, not evil, but for less than positive. I don't know what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah, force for good. Yeah. You know, it's scary to see that our politicians are taking that approach as well. You'll see our own politicians attacking each other on Twitter. And it's like, okay, if we're talking about adults in the room, you know, you guys are the elected officials. You're supposed to be the ultimate adults in the room. So, you know, let's see you act like it. So if we're taking, you know, if we're doing anything, we're taking a lead from them. But yeah, to take the cynical side of things of the Positive Cynicism podcast, isn't it human nature to take something good and kind of destroy it? That seems to be what we're doing with Twitter and other social media platforms.
Yeah, I don't understand. So we're running out of time, so let's hit the wheel one last time. Last topic.
One more.
Okay.
I love your responses. That your responses before you read off the topic is my favorite. You know,
like I said, I've not seen these, so these are new to me. We don't need no stinking badges. And that was probably racist in the way that I just said it, but we don't need no stinking badges.
Well,
where do we start?
Where do we start? What's the what's the implication? We have a shutdown government over the wall, trying to keep out our neighbors to the south.
What do you know? Real quick, what movie that line is from? I'm trying to think.
Yes, the movie's from The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Okay.
It's on the AFI top 100 list. Most people can't tell you the, you know, where it's derived from. It's just such an infamous quote. And so, you know, let's not break down a movie that most people haven't seen. Let's break down the type of quote that it is. What other, you know, quotes now go beyond the product that it came from. For example, I was just watching an Australian film called Occupation, and it's aliens that come down to Earth and occupy part of Australia. And there's a part of the humans fight back, and the small band of rebels, you know, start breaking people out of these alien camps. And as one group of humans are being transported via this just large vehicle, the human rebels, you know, attack the vehicle, bust in through the top of the van to pull people out. And one guy says, "Come with me if you want to live." And my ears kind of perked up because I'm like, are they ripping that off? Like immediately I thought, are they ripping that off? And then the character in the movie says, "I've always wanted to say that." And of course, you know, that's a line from Terminator. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of those things that we're getting to the point in talking about, you know, how far the 80s are from today, that, you know, how many quotes now would, you know, today's youth say, but not really even know where it came from. You know, "I'll be back" is another obviously line from that. And then, "Come with me if you want to live." But yeah, you know, they're infamous. They become timeless and oftentimes transcend the actual film or you know, television program in which, you know, they actually came from.
Yeah, I don't know how many times on a weekly basis, either out loud or just to myself, I say, "You're killing me, Smalls," because
right,
it's just a quote. And I mean, The Sandlot is a good movie, but I don't think it's a, I don't think the movie is on the same level as the quote. But I was looking at a different, it's going to take this in a different topic or a different direction, is I just looked up the quote from Treasure of Sierra Madre. And the actual quote is, "Badges, we ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges." And
nice.
I was just going with, you know, quotes that aren't actually quotes from the movie, like "Play it against Sam," "Luke, I'm your father," and, and some other ones where we have these quotes that we think are the actual ones, but we are wrong. And we're just spreading more fake information.
Just, yeah, just more fake news out there. Boy, I mean, that is an entire episode in itself of breaking down misquoted films. That's excellent. And I did not know that that was a misquote. And, you know, that's also that quote gets appropriated in so many different ways. You know, how many times do you say it in a different terms? You know, it's like, we need vodka for this drink, but we don't have any vodka. Vodka, we don't need stinking vodka. You know, it's, and you know, we'll use, you know, rum instead. You know, I don't. So, not only is it, you know, misquoted, but then it's, you know, turned into something completely different for a totally different purpose. So, again, the power of mass communication, the power of pop culture, in connecting us, and you know, how it infiltrates our daily lives to the point that it you know, the great lexicon of a society can involve not only quotes from movies, but then misquotes from movies that then get turned into something also turned into something completely different. So now we're like three stages away from the initial meaning and the initial actual quote from the movie.
Yeah, and I think that is a perfect way to wrap up the episode, because it kind of ties back in with a lot of things that we've discussed, where perception versus reality is two sides of the same coin, I guess you would say.
And how pop culture often shapes that, or we allow it to shape our own perceptions of reality, sometimes for good and sometimes not.
Exactly. All right. Well, I'm going to end it there because I really don't have anything else to say. And we are past my 1 hour self-imposed time limit. If you're listening, thanks for listening. Travis, I think this was a fun episode. I think we may have to do this again in the future.
Listen, I'm thinking maybe instead of doing this every year, every half year, at the midway point of every year, we can kind of do a half year in review with the same concept.
I think so. This was fun. Again, this show is all about evolving and just coming up with new ideas. So if we can't come up with something for next month, we may do this again next month. But I think we'll have something to talk about in February, because it will be Oscar month and the Golden Globes.
There will be lots to talk
about. Yes. Anyway, Travis, before we get out of here, anything you want to promote?
I want to plug 2019.
Okay.
Let's keep the positivity going for 2019. 2018 was rough in a lot of ways for a lot of people for different reasons. 2019, new page, new book. Let's keep the positivity going for 2019.
It's a good idea. And I know I am taking this little challenge, which you can find out more about on positivecynicism.com. It is inspired by Diamond Dallas Page, DDP. It's the Positively Unstoppable 16-Week Challenge. And it's kind of kicking my butt into gear to do something productive instead of it's more about creating content than consuming content this year.
Amen.
Yeah. All right. That's Travis Yates. You can find him on Twitter at PopCultIQ. You can find me on Twitter at ChadSmart. Thanks for listening. Check out all the other shows here on the Jittery Monkey Podcasting Network. And as always, question everything and do something positive.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.